Hello. Today we're talking about eating disorders, a term covering a range of conditions from anorexia nervosa to binge eating. My guest today has made huge inroads in furthering our understanding in the field, as well as helping to dispel some of the stigma around these disorders. Janet Treasure is a professor of psychiatry at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London. Her research is all about the relationship between disorder behaviour and the brain, trying to get a handle on what drives such conditions and developing more effective treatments. Her study of twins in the 1980s offered one of the earliest arguments in favour of a genetic link to anorexia nervosa, rather than the purely psychological motivation that was generally accepted at the time. Janet is emphatic that increasing awareness and changing attitudes around eating disorders is vital. She says the old model was all about privacy and confidentiality, and we need to move on from that. Sure, we need to be sensitive, but there used to be real stigma, an idea you couldn't talk about. Now that's changing. There's more openness, and that can only be a good thing. Professor Janet Treasure, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, eating disorders is a term that covers a whole range of behaviours, yes, as I mentioned. To start off, can you give me a sense of how common they are in the UK today?
That's a difficult question to answer because they were known about in 1888 and named anorexia nervosa was, but bulimia nervosa was only named in 1979, and some of the newer eating disorders were only named in 2015. So without knowing what we're looking for, counting has been difficult. And then bringing up an issue you talked about, there's this conflict that people can see it, but the individual themselves doesn't see that there's anything wrong and doesn't want to change. So when you're asking them what is wrong, they don't say. So that can be a difficulty counting it. We know that when we went house to house looking for all eating disorders in adults, only 20% who had it had been to the doctors for treatment.
So it's difficult to count, but the Children and Young People's Mental Health Study by NHS Digital has shown a real increase since 2015.
Yes, but that was children. And part of the surge definitely was related to COVID.
Sure.
And that was internationally. But in adults, it's not counted. And even if you ask the questions, you don't get the right answer because they don't see it as a problem.
Right, yes.
But I think over time, as you say, people do know about it and there's less shame and stigma. So people can go for help, but often the help's not there because the services are very limited.
I know that early intervention is incredibly important in these cases. So for any parents, carer or friend who might be worried, what are the early indicators of an eating disorder?
They can be variable, but thinking of terms of absence, sort of dropping out of things, not coming for meals, obviously that's perhaps quite obvious, but not going out with friends, withdrawing to the room, that sort of thing. Behaviours, thinking of over-exercising, the behaviours related to eating, changing the diet, etc. And then changes in personality and general mood, that sort of thing too.
And do you think public perception of eating disorders has changed much in recent years? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, there used to be so much stigma attached to them.
Yes. Well, the perception is interesting because it is so visible. So I come from Derbyshire, and there the history of anorexia nervosa shows posters advertising going and seeing this damsel who's fasting, and the Welsh fasting girl was a famous example. So they were regarded as a spectacle over 150 years ago. Then it became relating to being vain, wanting to follow fashion and doing it deliberately. So that was sort of more stigma about it rather than this wonderment that people could do such a thing.
We'll talk about this more later on because it's an area I know you've done a huge amount of work. But how much do we know about why someone might develop an eating disorder? I mean, you say it's not about vanity or wanting to be thin.
Yeah. We still know very little, really, about the causes, but we know some of the markers of the disease, that it occurs in adolescence, early adolescence. So that's a key aspect. Then another thing we know about is the fact that it does run in families. So if you have twins, it's more likely that both of them have the disorder, and they may have mothers or aunts with the disorder too. So something genetic. Then if you look at the developmental trajectory, you can see signs, markers of what we see in the genetics coming through a little bit. And that's been very interesting, but also confusing, because there are some things that are shared across bulimia and anorexia, but others that are polar opposite. So a developmental trajectory of people with anorexia nervosa is to be on the lean side with a rather shy, perfectionistic personality, whereas people with bulimia, even when they're tested little babies, sucking on a teat, suck more vigorously and have a higher weight trajectory throughout their life. So, that's a very interesting.
Some things in common and others, as you say, are opposite to each other. Well, Janet Treasure, you were born in Derby in 1952. Yeah. You actually moved back there in recent years, and it's somewhere that has a special career connection for your family.
Yes, because my grandfather worked at Rolls-Royce, so did my father, and so did my son now.
Right. What was your childhood like there?
Oh, it was, well, it's very different to the childhood of my grandchildren now. I mean, I remember walking down brooks and going via different houses and making dens in the hedgerows, whereas everybody's much more carefully controlled now. But it was a very pleasant one.
And you attended local grammar school, but I gather you didn't particularly excel academically.
Well, I used to get a lot of criticism and because of spelling badly and not writing neatly. So I never really felt I was a flourishing academic example until sixth form, when I was just doing maths, physics, chemistry, where nobody fussed about that sort of thing.
You didn't have to write essays?
No.
So sixth form is when you started to enjoy science. Where did the interest in medicine in particular and the human mind and body come in?
It came quite late. Initially, I thought I'd do science, but perhaps an applied science. But then there was a programme on the television called The Expert, which was a forensic scientist. And I thought, really, that's really interesting. I'd love to do that. And then seeing that medicine is a detective story and psychiatry is a perfect detective story, because you're going from the genes to the whole lifespan.
Well, I mean, psychiatry is something that came later, but you decided that medicine then was the career for you. And it was actually in secondary school that you first saw the impact of anorexia.
Yes. Well, I didn't know it was anorexia, but it was a new girl came to our, about the fifth form, I think, at school. And in fact, she lived just up the road from me. So we arranged to walk in together. But then over the holidays, she's lost a lot of weight. And then suddenly she disappeared from school and nothing was said. And it was all a big mystery, which later, of course, I thought she probably had an eating disorder. I don't know what happened to her, because it wasn't talked about.
So she's taken out of school and hidden away. That's terrible. Well, your A-levels, Janet, in maths, physics and chemistry earned you a place to study medicine at the University of London. You then did your PhD in physiology. And although you weren't focused on eating disorders at this point, your thesis subject actually did have a connection, didn't it?
Yes, it was very much related to the hypothalamus, which is, of course, a central point of appetite control and stress response as well. So those two connections were there.
You earned your Bachelor's of Medicine and Surgery in 1978, and as new doctors do, began training placements in various hospital departments. But you'd also recently got married, and your husband got an offer of a fellowship in the US.
Yes, a place where I was a very famous cardiac surgeon, and he had about 20 foreign fellows. So we went to Birmingham, Alabama.
Your husband was also a surgeon.
He was a surgeon, And I managed to get a job there too. I was in a renal unit, looking at diet on blood pressure and things. So a bit related to where I am now, I suppose.
Well, after a year in Alabama and heavily pregnant with your first child, you moved back to London.
Yeah.
You had your son Sam shortly after. But then your carefully laid plans changed.
Well, I was planning to have maternity leave, and I'd already started making inquiries of thinking where I was going next. And I live very near the Maudsley Hospital, which is a very famous postgraduate training for psychiatry. And I realised that that really was something that would fit well. And so that was my plan. However, I was rung up when my son was 2 months old and asked whether I would be able to do a locum because somebody had dropped out of their training position.
A temporary placement, yeah.
So would I be able to start earlier? And I was very interested in that. I was able to ring up my mother-in-law, who'd had 9 children, and say, would you be able to come and help look after your grandson? And she agreed.
So because of this position that came up,
yes,
you went back to work rather sooner than you'd hoped.
Yes.
Well, they were then suddenly, this is February 1981, working at the Maudsley Psychiatric Hospital in South London, and the hospital is linked to King's College Institute of Psychiatry, where you've remained ever since, and then it's just sort of next door to the hospital, yeah, isn't it? And you got to work alongside the great Gerald Russell, who'd recently published one of the first descriptions of bulimia nervosa.
Yes,
hadn't he?
Yes. I mean, so that was amazing luck to be able to work with this world expert in eating disorder, and was very exciting. Yes, so he'd written a paper in 1979 describing a condition that he called an ominous variant of anorexia nervosa. And he described 30 case stories. He was a very good clinician, and he would be able to elicit patients' stories and get the essence of them. And that's what this paper had. And then, you know, bulimia was recognised everywhere.
Mm. Well, you had your second child, a daughter, Jean, in 1983. And a year later, you secured a research fellowship in the group with Gerald Russell. And at this point, you begin studying eating disorders from a range of different perspectives.
Yes, I was very much looking at endocrine function and reproductive function and seeing how things regress, the pubertal changes. So that was quite an interesting axis.
Mm. And as we've already talked about, I mean, there was significant stigma around anorexia and bulimia. But contrary to the entrenched attitudes about keeping quiet, you found people with first-hand experience remarkably forthcoming.
Yes, people with lived experience were very willing to sort of talk about it and try to understand it, because they were just as puzzled as we were. And the parents as well, you know, they really found it hard to understand what was going on. And the parents were very eager to have more biological research done. We weren't able to get, well, any research funded, such as thinking that eating disorders were biological. But a wonderful lady ran Cycle Madagascar and Cycle Vietnam, enough to get PhD students who could look at the parents' role, who could look at biological factors. And that was transformational, being able to get those early bricks in the wall.
And, I mean, it was quite a radical approach at the time, wasn't it? This first-hand experience.
Yes, yes, because people did feel the shame and weren't often willing to talk about it. But I was in a very lucky position of teaching medical students, many of whom had an eating disorder, you know, approached me and wanted to do something, written books with them. An interesting girl who had an eating disorder and was a fine artist. She did the most wonderful illustrations for the book I wrote to try and help people understand what an eating disorder was.
Well, Janet, your hard work didn't go unnoticed. In 1987, you were made a lecturer in psychiatry and then a senior lecturer soon after. And it's at this point that you began this project that was to have a massive impact on the field. In the late 80s, you and your colleague Tony Holland began a study of twins with eating disorders, comparing around 45 pairs of sisters. Mm-hmm. Talk me through what was involved.
What we did was talk to both of the twins about their eating disorder, but also about the personality traits that we thought were these perhaps, we call them endophenotypes, early signs of what the genetics is and how it manifests during life. And the interesting modelling is basically comparing how common it is for identical twins to both have a trait or an illness versus the non-identical twins. And we found a large difference. So it was about 80% both had an eating disorder in the identical, and it was only about 20% in the non-identical. And when we looked at sort sort of perfectionism, which is a personality trait. Similar ratios were found with those sort of things.
So that's a huge difference. You're saying it's much more likely that both identical twins would have the disorder than it would be if they were non-identical twins.
Yeah, that's right.
And, of course, that's pointing to a genetic origin.
Yes.
What sort of reaction did you get when you shared your ideas?
Well, sometimes I felt I was going to get eggs thrown at me as an audience because it did seem to be going against the trend of, you know, the sort of psychological, social aspects of eating disorders, and was a bit surprising for some clinicians. You know, I think the funding sources had all been going the other way. But there were lots of biological changes in psychiatry then. So there were brain scans were introduced, preliminary genetic studies looking at the neurotransmitters and so it all fitted in with the move of thinking of the brain in psychiatry, and that eating disorders was a sister to all these other psychiatric disorders.
Mm. The fact that there is this genetic component to eating disorders, that still isn't widely understood, is it?
No, that's right. And because we've been having a survey of how guidelines get translated into different branches of medicine, what we find is quite disappointing that quite a few doctors and medical staff do not consider that it is a disorder that has a biological origin.
So they're as unaware of it as the wider public.
That's right, yes.
Well, in 2000, Janet Treasure, you were made a full professor, and around that time you were working with Ulrike Schmidt, one of your colleagues in the university's eating disorder unit, to develop a treatment model for anorexia nervosa. Tell me about what you're proposing, what you call the cognitive interpersonal maintenance model.
So this was because we saw things in the individual themselves that predisposed to an eating disorder and got entangled with it. So it did fit with their personality traits, their cognitive traits of valuing certainty and perfectionism and being able to see detail. So that's the cognitive aspect of it. Then the emotional aspect was more of a sensitivity to punishment than reward. So doing anything to avoid anxiety, etc., because that gives anxiety. But what makes a big impact, particularly on anorexia nervosa, are all the secondary things to the illness. So we get the starvation effects, and they are profound. So the brain shrinks by 6% in anorexia nervosa, which is much higher than any other psychiatric disorder other than dementia. So schizophrenia is sort of 2 to 4%. And, of course, the impact in the brain is happening at this critical time of development, adolescence, where everything is being restructured. The most important complex aspects of who our self is and who we are, what we are, is forming. And so that gets impacted. And that makes recovery quite difficult.
Based on this work, you developed a training course for parents and carers of people with anorexia, where they'd get support from individuals who'd been through the disorder themselves and also practice something called motivational interviewing.
Yes, so, well, that was another aspect because, you know, with us as doctors, people come to us with a problem and we solve it for them. Whereas eating disorders, they didn't want it solving. It fitted their personality style. They liked the rules and the certainty. So motivational interviewing is a technique where you learn how to gradually play with the idea of change. And rather than saying, yes, you want to change, you think of it, oh, you're on a line of 0 to 10. Where are you on your willingness to change? It might be minus 2, you know, that sort of thing. So it allows you to get more information about the meaning and ideas that change could be possible without clashing in values.
And while we're talking about motivational interviewing, I gather you've since brought that into trials of treatment for patients with type 1 diabetes.
Yes. So people with diabetes have a threefold higher risk of having an eating disorder. The whole spectrum. Some have a more anorexic type, some have a more bulimic type. So it's one of the many conditions that seems to have a higher prevalence in eating disorders. Autism spectrum is another one, obsessive compulsive disorder. So there are many varieties of eating disorder, depending what background extra bits you bring to it.
Well, in 2012, Janet, you took partial retirement stepping back from the clinical side, but staying on at King's for lecturing and research. Tell me about that decision.
Well, both of my parents had dementia. So that was a big, sudden thing we had to work on. And so that was one of the main motivators.
And they were back in Derby?
Back in Derby.
Right. And it must have been a challenging time. But in the midst of all that, you got a surprise recognition. In 2013, you were awarded an OBE for services to people with eating disorders. Do you remember finding out?
Yes. I mean, I remember it was a Christmas time and I think I got the award in the June and sort of very puzzling. No, I still don't know who it was or why
it was. Who put you forward, right?
Yes. And I really appreciate it.
Well, Janet, we've already mentioned your twins' work prompted interest in the potential genetic associations of eating disorders. It was a slow but steady process, but by 2019, an international cohort was ready to publish this huge genetic study involving data from thousands of patients.
Yes.
That must have been a game changer.
It certainly has been, and it shocked people because rather than the association with just the psychiatric disorders, which was there, and especially with obsessive compulsive disorder, we had this link with metabolism and growth. So we only have done it on anorexia, finished it on anorexia. The bulimia one is still collecting more data and analysing the data, although we have little hints of what it is. But the anorexia one showed that there was a tendency for growth to be smaller. Leanness was common, and facets of metabolism, insulin, etc., did differ from the rest of the population. And, you know, the preview of the bulimia data is that they're both at other ends of the spectrum of metabolism, whereas there's less clarity in exactly what psychiatric disorder it's a bit like. But to have a disorder that has both biological metabolic factors and brain factors is unusual.
Yes, the origins in both the mind and the body.
Yes.
I mean, this data became a key source for others to follow your lead and it has also influenced all sorts of approaches to eating disorders. But a big moment for the field came in 2022 when the Royal College of Psychiatrists published its National Medical Emergencies and Eating Disorders Guidelines, known as MEED. Now, these were primarily for medical staff, but also offered advice for patients and carers, which is, of course, what you'd been advocating as part of a holistic solution. Now, here's a rather disturbing quote from the Royal College of Psychiatrists as they launched the guide. Hospital admissions for eating disorders have increased by 84% in the last 5 years, with children and young people the worst affected. They went on to note that signs that someone with an eating disorder is severely ill and in need of hospital treatment are often missed due to a lack of training and accessible guidance for frontline staff. I mean, with that in mind, what sort of impact did these guidelines have?
Well, we're still trying to disseminate them because there still is a bit of a prejudice and lack of knowledge about the management of the common problems that do occur in such patients. And the visibility of seeing how poorly somebody is and wanting to help, but then being rejected, it's not what doctors are used to. And so often they don't find it easy to manage such cases.
Well, Janet, let's come to your current work. Mm-hmm. Right now, you're involved in a project exploring how ketamine, an anaesthetic drug that's recently been trialled in treating depression, could be used as a treatment for people with anorexia.
Yes, well, the story of ketamine and eating disorders is interesting because in the 90s, a professor from Cambridge, knowing what ketamine does, that it breaks compulsivity and rigidity, gave intravenous ketamine to a group of anorexic patients and showed changes. Then also, we have a very interesting animal model of anorexia, that if you put a wheel in the cage of a rodent and then reduce their food intake, they will start running a large amount and don't eat enough. And so they quickly go into negative energy balance and can die from that. And adolescent animals are the most at risk. And there's a lot of parallels to anorexia, which is quite interesting. And so in the animal model, ketamine does influence and reduce the eating disorder. And it varies. The sensitivity to that depends on what stage of adolescence they're tested. So that is quite an interesting finding. So, yes, we're hoping to. We've got the money. We've got the funding. That takes a lot of time. But then getting all the statutory things things set up to be able to run the trial. So I think it's going to be after Christmas that we'll be starting it. But we're excited to have this wonderful paradigm that might help understand what's going on and targeting it.
I mean, do you think that something like ketamine might be some sort of wonder drug to treat people with eating disorders?
Yeah, I mean, it is fascinating because it has such a long-lasting effect in these animals. So you give it them once and it sort of changes all this. These processes, and we're only just fully understanding them, what goes on in puberty, how, you know, you switch these balances of being exciting or inhibiting and going for reward or punishment. So those sort of balances that require modulation of transmitters do seem to be key at this stage of life.
So looking ahead, what would you like to see as a focus for research? What wins does the field need?
Well, we have done well in people in the early phase of the disorder, training the parents and the parents really knowing how to persist in the face of, you know, stubborn resistance, which isn't easy. You know, it is very hard not to feel irritated or to give in to the eating disorder. So those are the things we have to train parents to sort of manage to stand above. But what we haven't got is the second line treatments for people who haven't responded to that. So these are the people whose admissions are keeping cycling. They're going in and out and in and out, you know, and we know that, what is it? The definition of madness is keep repeating what goes wrong. And so I think that that's what we've been doing, and we need other approaches. And we're developing more ways of treating these very severe ones more at home, so we can use the families and sort of give them the training that is needed. It's sort of complicated training and not necessarily cheap, but at least there's things that we can try which we haven't really had before, because as I say, we just kept repeating what started 150 years ago, Nursum in Hospital.
Janet Treasure, thank you very much for sharing your Life Scientific.
Thank you.